Syrian air defenses intercept missiles fired by Israel on the western province of Hama. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns recent steps by some Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel as a grave threat to the Palestinian cause. Also ahead, millions of Americans are faced with a Christmas nightmare as a political fight between President Trump and Congress leaves the government spending package in limbo. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Syria says its air defenses have repelled an act of Israeli aggression in the west of the country. The Syrian Defense Ministry said Israeli aircraft targeted the Masyaf area in the Hama countryside, but most of the missiles were intercepted. It added that the attack was launched from the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. Syrian Air TV aired footage showing air defenses responding to the Israeli attack. Israel frequently conducts air raids against positions inside war-ravaged Syria. The attacks are seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Political commentator Ken Stone says Israel is part of the US-led coalition that uses terrorists in the hope of changing the government in Syria.
We have to remember that Israel is part of the US-led coalition waging a war on Syria, an illegal war, in which the US and Canada and many other Western countries put terrorists into the country to try and force a regime change, and that failed. And there's only one province left, Idlib, where the terrorists are still holding sway. And the U.S. is also illegally occupying the entire eastern third of Syria with the help of their proxies in the SDF. And they are sitting on top of Syria's petroleum resources precisely in order to that the resurgent Syrian government does not have the resources available for reconstruction. So Israel is part of the game, part of the regime change game. They are failing. They are still lashing out, like the U.S., which is still sitting on Syrian oil. But the fact is that the Syrian government is going to win. It's going to retake every square inch of Syrian territory, as President Assad has said these long 9 years so far. And there will be a reckoning with the state of Israel. They will have to pay for all the crimes that they've committed against their Syrian neighbor, including the restoration of the Golan Heights, which is part of the sovereign country of Syria.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel, calling them a treacherous stab in the back of the Palestinians. In a letter addressing heads of 30 Arab and Islamic states, Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas, described the normalization deals as, quote, a major political sin. Haniyeh said the deals have emboldened the Israeli regime to intensify its aggressive policies against Palestine. This month, Morocco became the fourth Arab country to sign a normalization agreement with the regime. The United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan had earlier signed similar US-backed deals. All Palestinian factions have repudiated the normalization accords, considering them a betrayal of their cause. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel are a betrayal to the Palestinians and Islam.
Well, this is a betrayal of not just the Palestinians, but to Islam. You know, it's clear that Israel is in violation, and its crimes are just mounting. Its Judaization of Jerusalem, its settlements, its daily, almost daily killing, murdering of Palestinians. So it's very sad to see, but the Emirates is one thing. They're a puppet, small, they're not really the Arab world, but it's sad to see Morocco, although Morocco was power politics to get the Western Sahara recognized as Moroccan.
Elsewhere, the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reacted to US President Donald Trump's latest accusations against Tehran. In a tweet, Zarif criticized Trump for using, quote, a worthless photo to blame Iran for the recent attacks on the US embassy in Iraq. He said the outgoing US president will be responsible for any adventurism in the region. This comes after Trump accused Iran of being behind Sunday's strike on Washington's Baghdad embassy, saying he would hold Tehran responsible for any American deaths. Earlier, his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, made similar remarks, blaming what he called Iranian-backed groups for the attack. Iran has dismissed the accusations as irresponsible and false claims aimed at instigating tension in the region. Turning to other news, the fate of a U.S. coronavirus relief package hangs in the balance after Democrats and Republicans blocked each other's attempts to amend it. The Democrats in the House of Representatives blocked the Republicans' attempts to cut foreign aid from the federal spending bill, while Republicans refused to allow the increase in coronavirus payments to $2,000. President Donald Trump has demanded the changes after Congress passed a $900 billion emergency economic relief package on Monday. Now, failure to pass the package threatens the livelihoods of tens of millions of Americans and the broader U.S. economy. Unemployment benefits for 14 million Americans expire on Saturday. The stimulus is attached to a broader funding package, so the Americans also face the prospect of a government shutdown during the pandemic if the parties can't reach a consensus. Political commentator Frank Emsbach says the US president wants to unleash chaos and blame everybody else that is for it.
He can do nothing and let it die, and then everything has to start all over again, including the budget negotiations. The government gets shut down, and there's no relief. That happens after January 3rd. Or he vetoes it, which he has not said he's going to do, and then they would see if there's an override. I don't think there's the votes for that. Or there is a modification of the bill, which seems to be very, very difficult to do. I think he's going to posture until the last moment and then sign it reluctantly. But he may not. So I don't think anybody really knows exactly what's going to happen. What are the consequences? Maybe he's crazy like a fox, you see, and says he's going to blame everybody, leave the White House, and then run on the basis that these people can't do anything and are horrible people. And I wanted $2,000 and these guys prevented it.
U.S. President Donald Trump has caused more controversy by issuing a presidential pardon to members of the private security firm Blackwater. The pardon comes amidst a string of similar acts prior to his imminent departure in January.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a US company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with the crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives.
The Blackwater Four joined the likes of Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher and a US Army lieutenant who ordered his soldiers fire on innocent civilians in Afghanistan, killing three. But with Trump having various links to Blackwater and other US entities, is Trump pardoning his pals in one last farewell party prior to ability to do so ending with his presidency?
There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think I, at my age and in my medical condition, I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed. And after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again. The one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
COVID-19 still rages in the Americas region despite the government's efforts to contain the pandemic. Brazil recorded more than 58,000 new cases of the coronavirus, bringing the total number of infected people to over 7.4 million people. The country also logged more than 760 new deaths, taking the total death toll to almost 190,000. Elsewhere in the region, the United States reported over 3,400 new deaths and more than 221,000 daily cases. The US remains the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic, with over 18.6 million infections and more than 328,000 fatalities, despite Washington's efforts to speed up vaccination efforts. Rebel groups in the Central African Republic declare a three-day ceasefire in the run-up to the December 27 legislative and presidential elections. The coalition called on the government to similarly observe a truce over the period and urged President Fosson Arshons Tawandara to suspend the elections. They also accused the president of attempting to fix the vote. At the weekend, the government accused former president Francois Bozize of plotting a coup with the help of the rebels. Meanwhile, the UN has brought troops to the African country to help secure and monitor the elections. The elections are considered a key test of the conflict-torn nation's ability to regain stability. The UK and the European Union have finally secured an agreement over their future ties, setting the seal on Britain's referendum to leave the bloc. Bianca Rahimi has more.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion a year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As Christians around the world are celebrating Christmas, the festive occasion is also being observed in Iran, a predominantly Muslim nation. However, this year Christians are celebrating the most different Christmas amid the coronavirus pandemic. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that we have this pandemic time, I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country, and church rituals are no exception.
While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Knowing this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish, and everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Negotiators of a Brexit trade deal inched towards a compromise on fishing rights on Sunday, 20th of December, but missed a major deadline, raising the prospects of weeks without arrangements from 1st of January, even in the event of agreement. The teams led by Chief UK negotiator David Frost and his European Union counterpart Michel Barnier were expected to continue talks on Monday, despite the European Parliament notice that it would not vote on a deal if not secured by midnight on Sunday, 20th of December. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled, UK Faces Brexit Limbo After Talks Deadline Missed. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. Negotiators of a Brexit trade deal inched towards a compromise on fishing rights on Sunday, 20th of December, but missed a major deadline, raising the prospects of weeks without arrangements from 1st of January, even in the event of an agreement. The teams led by the Chief United Kingdom negotiator David Frost and his European Union counterpart Michel Barnier were expected to continue talks on Monday, despite the European Parliament's notice that it would not vote on a deal if not secured by midnight on Sunday, 20th of December. A UK government source said teams have been negotiating throughout the day and expect to continue tomorrow. Talks remain difficult and significant differences still remain. We continue to explore every route to a deal that is in line with the fundamental principles we brought into the negotiations. David Frost met Michel Barnier on Sunday afternoon to discuss the latest European Union proposals on fisheries, with the UK side posing a series of questions to be answered on Monday, raising some hope of progress. Britain's Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, said the talks had been derailed in recent days after the European Union put in some unreasonable demand on fisheries, but that he was still hopeful of an agreement before Christmas. I'm sure that a deal can be done, but obviously it needs movement on the European Union side, he said. The failure to meet the European Parliament's deadline means that ministers on the European Union Council representing the bloc's capitals may need to provisionally apply a deal on 1st of January to avoid a no-deal exit until Parliament votes later in the month. If the talks go much deeper into December, however, there may not be time for the European Union capitals to translate and to scrutinise the agreed text, leaving the United Kingdom to exit the transition period without new trade and security arrangements with Brussels. Contingency measures would have to be agreed to bridge the gap before a deal could come into force, but such a scenario raises the danger of ports and security services being left in legal limbo. Bernd Lange, the German chair of the Parliament's Trade Committee, the key body in the Chamber's ratification process, tweeted, "The consequences of no deal tonight is obvious. The European Parliament does not know the consolidated text, is not in a position to scrutinise before the end of the transition period. So make preparations now for a no deal period and agree emergency measures with the United Kingdom." A major sticking point in the talk remains the European Union's demand to be able to apply tariffs or entirely block the entry of British goods in the event of the government closing off access to UK seas after a transition period to phase in new fishing arrangements for European vessels. Under the British proposal, Boris Johnson insists that the UK flagged vessels have exclusive access to the 6 to 12 nautical mile zone off the British coast, fished for centuries by French and Belgian vessels. Such a move would lead to some British exports being kept out of its biggest market under a proposal Brussels has tabled. Michel Barnier tweeted, "In this crucial moment for the negotiations, we continue to work hard with David Frost and his team." The European Union remains committed to a fair, reciprocal and balanced agreement. We respect the sovereignty of the United Kingdom and we expect the same. Both the European Union and the United Kingdom must have the right to set their own laws and control their own waters. And we should both be able to act when our interests are at stake. His comments indicate that there has been some movement on the issue, with both sides able to take measures should their interests be threatened. But United Kingdom sources downplayed any suggestion of a breakthrough. The exhausted British team in the UK mission to the EU, many of whom have been away from home for the last 2 weeks, were served food at the British ambassador's residence as they worked throughout Sunday. Clement Beaune, France's European Affairs Minister, said he believed a deal with the United Kingdom remained doable. "We have given ourselves a few more days because we think that an agreement is still possible," he said. "It's hard, not sure, but worth a try. More than an agreement, we want a good agreement, in particular preserving fishing and fair conditions of competition." The negotiations should be concluded in the next few days. We know where our red lines are and what interests we don't want to sacrifice. All the political groups in the European Parliament, apart from the Greens, had agreed on the Sunday night deadline for a deal. Philip Lambert, the co-leader of the Greens, said, "The position that we defend is that negotiators should be allowed to work until the last minute and simply give us time in January and February to scrutinise and ratify any deal. I'm watching quite gleefully, I must say, because I was quite angry at my colleagues and now they will look stupid."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and greetings to our Christian listeners on the eve of Christmas, which the West regards as birthday of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, whom Islam considers as one of the five greatest messengers of God. Here we present you a prophecy about the advent of the last prophet by the virgin-born Messiah, as mentioned in the Gospel of Barnabas. "Know, O Barnabas, that for this I must have great persecution, and shall be sold by one of my disciples, that is Judas Iscariot, for 30 pieces of money. Whereupon I'm sure that he who shall sell me shall be slain in my name, for that God shall take me up from the earth, and shall change the appearance of the traitor, so that everyone shall believe him to be me. Nevertheless, when he dies an evil death, I shall abide in that dishonor for a long time in the world. But when Muhammad shall come, the holy messenger of God, that infamy shall be taken away. And this shall God do, because I have confessed the truth of the Messiah, who shall give me this reward, and I shall be known to be alive and to be a stranger to that death of infamy."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhis salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, praised cleverness. He regarded it as the only source of man's happiness and righteousness. He, peace be upon him, said, "The goodness of all coexistence and living together is a full measure. two-thirds of the measure are cleverness, and one-third of it is heedlessness. Nothing has a portion of good and righteousness except cleverness. That is because man feigns inattention to the things which he realizes and knows. How wonderful this maxim is! A religious scholar commented on it, saying, "Indeed, it has gathered together all the righteousness of the affairs of the world."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, talking about the beautiful conversations and dialogues which we find in the historical texts, we find one such conversation between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. The conversation is quite a long conversation that this student has with his teacher regarding high moral standards and universal ideals which can lead a human being towards perfection. In this conversation between the student and the teacher, the follower and the imam, Imam al-Baqir puts forth a lengthy discussion, but taking just bits and pieces, we find that in one place, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir, "Supply yourself with provisions from this world through the shortness of hope. Hasten, be quick to seize the purpose during the possibility of opportunity. And there is no possibility like the past days with the soundness of the body." Now, just to explain a little bit about what Imam al-Baqir is saying to his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, Imam al-Baqir says that supply yourself with the provisions of this world, right, by having a shortness of hope. Now, this lack of hope or this shortness of hope is not hope in the mercy of Allah or hope in the help of Allah or hope in the protection of Allah. No, these are all hopes which we must have, we need to have. This is talking about hope in the materialistic world, hopes in people, that perhaps people will help me, perhaps the materialistic world will come to me or it will help me. No, do not put your hopes in people. Do not put your hopes in the materialistic world. Put your hopes in the one who deserves to be put hope forwards, which is Allah. Put your hope in Allah. And then Imam al-Baqir says, hasten to seize the purpose when you have the opportunity. How many times, dear friends, do we lose an opportunity and then regret? And so Imam al-Baqir here says to Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, seize the opportunity when it has been given to you. And finally he says, remember that the soundness of your body, meaning your health, there is nothing as important as your health, which can help you to achieve your purpose. So while you have health, and may Allah always bless you with good health, make sure to seize the opportunity and put your hope in Allah. Beautiful words in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Imama of Imam al-Baqir was for 19 years. And especially from the time 95 to 114 when he passed away, This time was the time of spreading the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And the main factors, or one factor specifically, which made Imam al-Bakr to be able to spread the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt to Muslims in generally and in Shias in particular, it was the time of shift of power from Bani Umayyah to Bani Abbas. They were busy fighting against one another. Imam got the opportunity and he started spreading knowledge. When we look today at our Maraji, we find that most of the time they are not involved in politics, which we know. Most of the time our scholars, Maraji, they will do exactly as what Imam alayhi salam did. They will take the opportunity. If people are fighting for politics, our scholars will go to teach ulum of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And this, according to historians, the period was known as Ahadul Infiraj, grace period, when Imam alayhi salam decided to teach specifically the Shia and generally all Muslims, including Abu Hanifa and many other figures, came to learn from him.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Morocco and its King Mohammed VI were not late to fill the vacant seat of Rabat on the bandwagon of normalization. The latter joined their counterparts Abu Dhabi, Manama, and Khartoum on a journey whose route and destination were clear from the beginning. According to Israel, the majority of Arab regimes stand in line to conclude such agreements with the Zionist regime, with each regime having its own reasons. Relations between Israel and Morocco go back decades, despite the fact that the monarchy in Rabat had previously refused overt normalization. Yet the Moroccan king agreed in 1994 to open a liaison office with Israel to deal with economic affairs between the two sides. The not-so-surprising moment was not limited to the Israeli regime only, but also includes every observer of the course of developments in the region of West Asia and North Africa, one familiar with the historical Moroccan-Israeli relations. Although the Emirati and Bahraini normalization is linked to an internal American context, all this path is related to what goes beyond the establishment of mutual relations between the Arab regimes and the Zionist regime, as it falls within a wider regional context that leads to the process of fully ruining the Palestinian cause and the preparation for weaving new alliances in light of the new developments in the region. However, talking about a comprehensive normalization path does not contradict the fact that each regime's deal comes with its own set of bribes. This was evident in the U.S. President's declaration of recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara between Morocco and the Polisario Front. As usual, Donald Trump did not find anything wrong with buying and selling what he did not own, as long as the deal would strengthen Israel and weaken its enemies. The agreement slash barter was tendered quickly and only needed a tweet from the U.S. president to shed light on the price of the normalization, the Western Sahara, without mentioning the terms of the deal itself. A deal that the Trump administration urges to provide with the largest number of signatories before Trump leaves office, and perhaps top it with the Saudi cherry on top, with Jared Kushner deeming it last week as inevitable. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Israel and Morocco agreed to normalize relations in a deal brokered with the help of the United States, making Morocco the fourth Arab country to set aside hostilities with Israel in the past 4 months. As part of the agreement, Trump, who is due to leave office on January 20, agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara region. To discuss this issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hanan, who is a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hanan. Now, Morocco will establish full diplomatic relations and maybe resume official contacts with Israel as part of the Trump broker deal of last week. We understood that the past rushed deals by both Bahrain and the Emirates and also Sudan were brokered just to boost Trump's part in the U.S. elections, and yet he still failed to be reelected. What is the point of rushing a deal right now with Morocco, especially at this point in time when Trump in a month will be leaving the White House?
Well, thank you for having me. And I really don't think that Trump has anything to do with all those so-called peace treaty with the Arab world. This is a plan has been put in motion for a long time, and the American and the Israeli have that patience of implementing this kind of plan. And according to their strategic thinking, now is the right time to go ahead and start implementing those deals. As you said, the peace treaty between the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Sudan did not have any bearing on the election of Donald Trump, because the American population do not pay much attention into the foreign policy of the country. They are more worried about their paycheck. They are more worried about the corona disease, how to tackle it. And the foreign policy is the last thing on their mind. So I really don't think this has anything to do with the election. It's a policy has been put by the deep state, and it's the right time internationally for it to be implemented without any objection.
Mm-hmm. So as part of the agreement, we saw U.S. President Donald Trump agreeing to recognize, as if the U.S. is the legitimate maybe body of the world that recognizes or disagrees about certain sovereignties or whatnot over the Western Sahara for Morocco here, where there has been a decades-old territorial dispute with Morocco pitted against the Algeria-backed Polisario front. Now, this movement, which is a breakaway movement that seeks to establish an independent state in the territory, with just one tweet from Donald Trump, it has been removed from their authority and placed under the sovereignty of Morocco. But I mean, reading this makes me think it might have been actually Morocco that was trying to speed up this deal. I mean, can I be right about this? Am I being too hard on Morocco here?
No, you're not. I think you are right in a way, because when the circumstances was right for Morocco to go ahead and openly have the relationship with the occupation entity of Israel, then it start put their own demand. It's exactly the same thing like Sudan. They have put a price on normalization with Israel, billions of dollars. They put a price also to be removed out of the terrorist list, even though they had nothing to do with the 9/11, while Saudi Arabia is considered the best ally of United States in the area. So this does not make sense to the logical, you know, people who follow news. But I mean, Morocco would put some condition, and like you said, United States has no legitimate status to go ahead and approve who belonged to what. It's the same thing when Trump went ahead and signed with the audacity that he signed to give up Golan Heights mm-hmm. to Israel, like he owns it. But the problem is not the United States. The problem is the Arab world is silent. The Arab leadership, if there was a leadership, is silent. And that's what makes them more aggressive in their approach and demand.
Well, Palestinians have been very critical of the normalization deal, saying that the Arab countries have set back the cause of peace, if there was ever really a cause of peace, by abandoning a long-standing demand with Israel, by demanding Israel to give up land, at least give up land to the Palestinians before it receives such a recognition from the Arab states. But it really baffles me, you know, to see that Palestinians still believe that any of the normalizing states ever really cared for the Palestinian cause or the incremental genocide against the Palestinian people that has been taking place since the early years of the 1900s. Now, do you think that these acts of normalization will actually affect the lives of Palestinians, specifically inside the occupied territories and maybe in Gaza too?
Absolutely not. Palestinians are the biggest party who's losing from those treaty, not from the Arab treaties with Israel only, from their own treaty with Israel. Since Oslo until now, they lost more land in a peace treaty than they lost in war. I mean, you cannot make peace a treaty with aggression. And all those peace treaty are organized and designed just to keep the simple of divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. So what happened since the spring, the Arab Spring, if you notice that the Arab Spring hit nobody except the Arab republics, from Syria to Tunisia to little bit to Egypt to Libya, no kingdom or emirate of the Arab world has been even touched by the spring, by the Arab Spring. So this has been done tactically and masterfully also, to do this, to get all the people who are gonna oppose any peace treaty between the Gulf area or the kingdom, the Arab kingdoms everywhere, to be busy with their own problem. And that's what happened. Libya is no longer on the map. Tunisia is busy with its own domestic problem. Syria is still trying to get out of the war. Egypt is completely gone since Camp David.
And now the eyes are on Iraq as well.
Now it's the right time.
Well, I was telling you, now the eyes are on Iraq as well. They're trying also to break Iraq and divide it as well, to try and keep their power over the region of West Asia. But the White House has tried to get Saudi Arabia also to sign a normalization agreement with the Israeli entity, believing that if they agreed, other Arab nations will just follow through. But Saudi Arabia has signaled several times that it is not ready to do so. What is Mohammed bin Salman really afraid of here, Mr. Hanano? That why is he so hesitant in taking this step, despite the fact that he has already opened the Saudi airspace for Israeli planes? Supposedly, according to Israeli media, he has been in a different secret meetings with Netanyahu himself, along with Pompeo as well. So why is he so hesitant about it?
I think that he does not have the backup of the royal family. Had it been Nayef bin Abdulaziz in charge, like Mohammed bin Salman right now, I think the peace treaty will be signed with Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia has a domestic problem in the royal family. That's why this so-called Mohammed bin Salman is putting everybody in jail. I mean, he does not have the royal family backup, and he is worried that any decision, major decision like this one, might cause them to topple him and take him out of power. That's why he was instrumental, for example, in pushing Sudan into the treaty. He pushed, definitely we know that he pushed Bahrain into the treaty. So he's doing those, pushing those countries. So when the time comes for Saudi Arabia, it's the natural thing to happen. Everybody signed up, so we're not gonna be royal more than the royalty. So as far as Iraq, I really don't think Iraq is able to sign any peace treaty. Iraq is divided, as you know. It's a three country in one, and there is a huge opposition with people in a powerful position in the government to any peace treaty with Israel. Now, Kurdistan has a representation of Israel in there. They have a what they call, and Mossad, I heard that Mossad has an office in Kurdistan, but that does not go beyond that mm-hmm. small enclave in Iraq, and I don't think it has that much effect on the decision of the Iraqi government to go ahead with the peace treaty similar to United Arab Emirates or Bahrain.
Mr. Akil Hamanu, our political commentator with us from Atlanta, Georgia, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you for your contribution despite the time difference between us and yourself. And please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the Prime Minister of Lebanon is being put under investigation. Lebanon's outgoing Prime Minister Hassan Diab and three former ministers have been charged with negligence that led to the deaths of hundreds and injuries of thousands in the massive August Beirut port explosion. But Diab's office indicated that the Prime Minister would not comply with the investigation, saying in a statement that the judge in action had violated the Constitution by overstepping the role of the Parliament of Lebanon, which has a specialized court for the trial of top officials. Lebanese Prime Minister under investigation in this following report.
The Lebanese prosecutor investigating August's port explosion in Beirut filed charges last week against the caretaker prime minister and three former ministers, accusing them of negligence in relation to the deadly blast. Hassan Diab resigned as prime minister a few days after the explosion, but has since stayed on in an interim capacity. Fadi Sawan, the judge investigating the blast, who charged finance minister Ali Hassan Khalil, as well as Ghazi Zaitar and Yusuf Fenyanos, both former ministers of public works, was on the case. Sawan had previously questioned them only as witnesses, but Diab's office indicated the Prime Minister would not comply with Sawan's investigation, saying in a statement that Sawan had violated the Constitution by overstepping the role of the Parliament of Lebanon, which has a specialized court for the trial of top officials. The Prime Minister's statement continued that caretaker Diab's conscience is clear and that he had dealt with the explosion issue in a responsible and transparent manner. The explosion on August 4 was caused by the ignition of 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate, a highly explosive chemical compound commonly used as agricultural fertilizer, but also sometimes for mining explosives, which had been kept at the port for 6 years. This means the explosives were put there when Hassan Diab held the position of a professor at a private university in Lebanon. Meanwhile, those who were in power at the time have yet to be touched and asked about the matter. However, Judge Sawan's decision to prosecute the outgoing prime minister and former ministers is based on verified written correspondence sent to them, warning the officials about nearly 3,000 tons of explosive material at Beirut's port. Some families of blast victims have raised doubts about whether Sawan's probe would lead to full accountability for victims due to reported political interference and due to process issues of not touching those who allowed the shipment to dock and those who protected the explosive for 6 whole years. Former Prime Minister Najib Miati, who himself was caretaker Prime Minister when the ammonium nitrate entered the port, has not been called for investigation, which observers deem as a double standard in charging Diab over the blast.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ms. Gina Shamas, political commentator. Thank you very much, Ms. Gina, for being with us. Now, this is big news in Lebanon, where Fadi Sawan, the judge investigating the blast of Beirut of August 4, he charged Prime Minister Hassan Diab last week, which is along with former public worker ministers, whom are Ghazi Zaitar and Yusuf Fenyanos, and former finance minister Ali Hassan Khalil, with criminal negligence. Why not charge those who were in power when the ammonium nitrate shipment docked in Beirut port and was then stored in such a hazardous way as well?
Hello to everyone. It's amazing how much scrutiny this particular judge is going under. If we had half of such scrutiny of the work that the governments, one after another, in Lebanon had been done to them, we wouldn't be here. The judge has the right to accuse whoever he believes is supposed to be accused. And this should be respected unconditionally. And we are not the judge. We don't have the files in front of us, and we do not have the right to interfere in the judge's decision. We are very interested in making sure that the judge is free to make the decisions based on his own independence, based on evidence available to the judge. Now, the judge apparently believes that those people are in charge and they should be charged with and accused with these type of crimes, which is gross negligence, basically. We have to respect that.